this is the fourth and final lecture, and I really appreciate the attention that everyone's given, not just to me, but to Dan, and I've seen lots of people taking notes and asking really thoughtful questions. Some of the discussion in between has been really encouraging. Got to meet and know some of you better. And just the fact that you're here asking these questions and digging into this tells us something very special about you, and that is that you care about truth. So whether you're here because you already believe that the Bible is the Word of God, or because you're trying to discern what is true, or because you've had some doubts yourself about the Bible, we just encourage you to keep up with that spirit of genuine investigation, because what the Bible says is that God is seeking those who are seeking Him. And so we believe that, I believe, that God would want you to keep searching and that He would find you. This fourth lecture considers that if the Bible is the Word of God, and if we ought to approach it as a true record of His revelation to mankind, then it ought to be readable, it ought to be understandable, it ought to be free of plain contradictions. Its message should be clear enough, transparent enough, and consistent enough in its details so that a reading of a moderate ability could uncover its truth, that a rigorous examination can both understand it and attest to its veracity. That's the claim. But the objection is that this clear plan, the Bible, is really not so clear at all. Here are just a few selections that seem to catch people's eyes from multiple directions. Is God a God of war or a God of peace? Exodus 15, the Lord is a man of war, the Lord is His name. And then in a prayer in Romans 15, Paul says, may the God of peace be with you all. Amen. So He's a man of war, and He's a God of peace. Is God unchanging or is He changing? In Malachi 3:6, for I, the Lord, do not change. In Jonah 3, God relented of the disaster that He had said He would do them, and He did not do it. So does God change or doesn't He change? Is it Jesus and Elijah? No one has ascended into heaven except He who descended from heaven, the Son of Man. John makes the point that Jesus is unique. He went to heaven. But then 2 Kings 2 tells us that Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Does God want me to be married or doesn't He? Proverbs 18:22. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. So if you have a wife, God wanted you to have a wife and He loves you. There you are. According to 1 Corinthians 7, are you free from a wife? Don't seek a wife. I was hoping I'd see some chuckles from that. What do we think about this? Does God want you to be married or not? It sounds like yes and no. Don't you hate it when people say yes and no? Is God really telling the truth here? Examples abound from seemingly contradictory bits of wisdom in the Proverbs to impossible to reconstruct chronologies when someone obviously got the number wrong. I mean, He reigned for 10 years over here and 18 years over here. And then there are plain teachings of Jesus that seem to butt heads with other places. For instance, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, do not let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. When you do a good deed, just let it be done in secret. But then later He says, let your deeds be done among men that they may see your good works and glorify God. Well, which is it? And so it just seems like the Bible is just plainly contradictory. So the objections are compounded here. And they are so compounded, I'm going to have a chart with lots of arrows, and I hope it makes sense. But I'm going to work on that so that we can just very quickly simplify it. But the first contradiction or objection is the Bible contradicts itself. God just isn't clear. The text itself testifies that the Bible is not from the mind of a God who values transparent communication or even a factual consistency. The stories just sort of change as you go along. Any parent who listens to a child's story, what happened? Well, Joe and Sally Joe. And okay, wait a second. Red flags are going up. The story's changed. The facts have changed. Tell mommy, tell daddy the truth. Stop lying. And so when we approach a story and the Bible, it seems like all these facts are sort of getting muddled. Isn't it inconsistent? Isn't the plan not very clear? And so maybe this is a lie. It doesn't sound true. Bill Mayer, and he may not take him very seriously, he's a comedian, but he has a really pungent way of putting things. He says the Bible looks like it started out as a game of Mad Libs. It just looks like somebody just sort of threw a bunch of things together and voila, there's your religion. Which, by the way, if you just take this back to the second lecture, would men die for something like that? I'm not going to go down that line of reasoning, but just think about that. Would men die for a game of Mad Libs? But that's what he thought. American author Mark Twain lent a different weight to the scriptures in his fictional, posthumously published work, Letters from Earth. He says of the Bible, it is full of interest. It has noble poetry in it, some clever fables, some blood-drenched history, some good morals, the wealth of obscenity, and upwards of 1,000 lies. Interestingly, James Gibbons, an American cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church in the late 19th and early 20th century, remarked that the scriptures are not of themselves clear and intelligible, even in matters of highest importance. You would think, you know, that the plain things would be the main things. That's what we hear, sometimes hear people say, you know, the things that are really necessary are at least clear. You know, some of these things that aren't clear are really not necessary. James Gibbons is an American cardinal. He says, even things that are really important aren't very... Finally, someone that Dan spoke some about in the first two lectures, Bart Ehrman, textual critic, New Testament scholar, professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and best-selling author of Misquoting Jesus, maintains that multiple writers of the Bible really means multiple stories, and therefore the inevitable contradiction. He says different authors have different points of view. You can't just say, I believe the Bible. When you say, I believe the Bible, does that mean you believe in Matthew or in Mark? Because Matthew says something different than Mark. And Luke. And when John tells his story, wow, that's really different. So when you say, I believe in the Bible, you believe in what? What parts of the Bible? Because whenever you read the Bible, you have to understand you're looking at different stories. The point is that you must choose what views within the Bible you are going to hold, because to hold them all would be, furthermore, if God were interested in good communication with man, supposing he worked the miracle of inspiring man to write these words, why did he not bother to preserve them as originally written? And this is something that Dan touched on quite a bit in this first one. I'm going to come back and look at this a little more carefully here in more detail. Professor Ehrman, Mark Ehrman, the writer of Misquoting Jesus, and a number of other books that really try to cast a lot of doubt on the scriptures. He is a textual critic by profession. It is his chosen vocation. So he makes a living off of these numbers. He's fond of pointing out the staggering number of variations found in the manuscripts. In the Greek manuscripts, it is agreed upon that there are 138,162 words in the Greek New Testament. Dan gave you the conservative estimate of the number of variations. I'm going to give you the liberal estimate. 200 to 400,000 variations. That means when you look at a document with 138,162 words, there are more than twice as many variations as there are actually words. Now, why are there so many variations? Before we look at the specific part of the objection that God isn't very clear why there's so many variations in the manuscripts, I'd like to list this next major objection because I think it will help us to answer this. And that is that Christians are not honest. That is that when we read our Bibles and we see that there are plain contradictions in the Bibles, well, we just sort of gloss over those and say, remember, the main things are the plain things are the main things, and, you know, let's not worry so much about 10 years, 18 years. You know, was it the third day, or was it really the fourth day that Jesus was raised from the dead, or the second day, and what does it really matter? This is a compound objection, and the idea is that Christians sort of cherry-pick passages to believe or not to believe. Someone once asked me, isn't it true that Christians who don't wear tassels will go to hell? Because the Bible says that God's people should wear tassels, fringes. That's what it says in the Law of Moses. And so he tried to pin me on this question. There's a basic assumption there that is faulty, and maybe we'll have time to discuss that in the Q&A. But the connection between these two objections, I think, will become obvious as we explore this. And the first major objection, either the original manuscripts themselves, the words that God first revealed to the writers, these manuscripts were perfectly clear and without contradictions, but God allowed it to be lost over time. And so God allowed these perfect manuscripts to be lost, or it was messed up in the originals and the Christians did a bad editing job. Okay, so those would be the points that we would see in these objections, is either God just allowed these originals to be lost and we don't know what they really are anymore, even with good, rigorous copying, or it was bad to begin with and Christians tried to patch it together and the editing job was just a really bad editing job. In the first case, God appears inept, doesn't he? He just sort of forgot, misplaced some things, and you know, we found them years later, and you know, we lost some stuff. But in the second point, early Christians are deceptive and conniving. This is the second major objection, really. It's a conspiracy. Contradictions get ignored. Christians aren't honest. They do a bad editing job here, realizing the Bible is not good. We're going to fix it so it appears right, which is the same thing here. We know it doesn't look right, but now we have so many copies, we can't change the actual text. We'll just change it in storytelling. And so Well, the early ones who altered the text in the first place are dishonest. That would be the number one objection. Or number two objection, the ones today who read it with bias are also dishonest. Do you see the objection? Before we deal with reading it with bias, we really need to deal with the editing job of the Bible. Christians need to stop insisting, this is the objection, stop insisting on believing all of the Bible as we have it today, give up on the notion that it is God's inspired word and cease following it wholesale. Maybe give up on Bible study totally. Or they at least ought to admit the Bible is a book to be read selectively, recognizing the helpful bits and discarding the rest. So either stop reading the Bible altogether, or just admit that you read it bits and portions at a time and discard the rest, that you actually selectively read the Scripture. That's the compounded objection. And again, I told you to be a little muddled, but we'll clear this up quickly. It's a pretty convincing case, I think. But we want to be fair. We want to raise the objection. We also want to challenge the objection to see if there's a validity to this claim that the Bible's full of contradictions. Where does the evidence lead us? Before we actually examine any of the apparent contradictions, so as not to ignore the apparent contradictions, we first must unravel some of this mess. Again, Dan's already dealt with some of this issue, and he urged us to reach a verdict based on the reliability of the manuscripts in which our Bible is based. And he presented a great deal of information. I'm not going to repeat very much of what he said, but Bart Ehrman, this textual critic, best-selling author of Misquoting Jesus and also Jesus Interrupted, compares the transmission of our scriptures, of the Greek text that our English translation is based on, to the parlor game that is telephone. You ever played telephone? Where you sit in a circle with a bunch of, you know, giddy high schoolers and you whisper something in someone's ear. You don't want anybody else to hear. And then when you say, let's go to Chuck E. Cheese for pizza, by the time it gets around, it's my mom has a booger on her face or something. Like it just changes. That was on the spot. That was really bad. But that's what happens. And it's supposed to be funny because by the time we get it all the way around the room, we're all supposed to have a good laugh. And that's what the transmission of the scriptures looks like. Is it started off as this story of this really good teacher who had these nice ideas that he probably learned from Buddha. And he comes all the way down here, and now he's the Son of God. He's raised from the dead, and he's got these 12 apostles, and they're saying, repent and be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins. How did it change? Well, it's a telephone game. But is this really best illustration of what happens when the scriptures are transmitted, that there's sort of all this garbly mess? Turns out not. And I'm going to give you some quick reasons why, and I hope these are helpful to you for anyone that comes with this suggestion, or maybe you're thinking this is how it happened, because it didn't. First of all, the message is written, not spoken. Have you ever played a telephone game? Okay, if you have, it's spoken, and that's part of the fun. What would it be like if you tried to write it? It wouldn't be any fun at all, because the message would just go, and let's go to Chuck E. Cheese and get some pizza. That would be the ha-ha-ha. It's not fun. You know, the fun is getting garbled, but if it's written and not spoken, then wow, look at it. You know, everything's going to look exactly like what it was before. But then rather than just one line being available, we actually have multiple lines that are available. So instead of just saying one thing, it's part of a story. So if I told you a story, once there was a little girl named Goldilocks, and she went through a skip in the woods, and she came across this cottage, and in the cottage she found Chuck E. Cheese, let's get some pizza, and she decided to sit down and eat these three. What line was added? I mean, you would quickly discern, oh, based on these multiple lines, this isn't making sense. This must be an error. But by the way, I don't see it in these other manuscripts. And that's also a point here. You're not playing the game alone. There are a multitude of manuscripts that are being compared. So by the time you get down here and you're making copies of copies of copies with other copies that are available. So it's not just one person whispering in the ear of another person, or just one person writing down something and giving to another person. It's 6, 7, 8, 9, 20, 30 people writing down multiple copies. Now, do errors creep in? Certainly. There's still a lot of other copies being made. Do you see where the error is? Have you noticed it yet? Bingo, Joe, you got it. Here on the last one, he's got good eyes in the very back. This last line, this fourth line, there's one little error. But when you start cross-referencing it against all of these other pieces, what would it be like if there was a telephone game, and even if it was spoken, but you start off with the same message, and there were five different games going on? By the time you got done, what if you compared the last thing that was said with all of these games? Wouldn't you stand a better chance of discovering what was the original message? That's what's going on here, but it's written with multiple copies. Copies that are cross-referenced again and again over generations so that when errors do occur, they are quickly found, quickly checked. And so this means that actually a long period of time for transmission of scriptures doesn't just work against the truthfulness and accuracy of scriptures, but it works for it. Because there's more time for cross-reference, more time for check, more generations comparing multiple copies, which means that we actually have a very good check. The scriptures that we have being very accurate. As they transfer forward, we have a multitude of scriptures. Dan gave some reference here to over 4,000 Greek manuscripts alone. That's just the Greek. When it's translated into Latin, when it's translated into Coptic, when it's translated into Aramaic, when it's translated into a number of other translations, we're not including that number in the over 4,000. We have a lot of other translations available, plus 10,000 Latin, so many, many more other translations. And then, besides the translations of the scriptures, we have commentaries, we have sermons, we have personal correspondence, we have letters to churches, just the scriptures, and then so many more. So when we start researching here, we think about the significance of these contradictions. Let me tell you this. There are errors in the manuscripts. There are. And I think for a long time, this is what really shook me years ago. I did not know that there are errors in the manuscripts. One year when I was young, my 16-year-old brother, I was 13 at the time, my 16-year-old brother first got a car. And got in, my dad and my brother and I were going to Wednesday night Bible study. We had a Bible study growing up on Wednesday nights. We got in the truck, and here we go. And Dad says, "How's the engine run?" "Oh, fine, fine." "When did you last check your oil?" "My brother had the car for about a week, and my dad expected him. You check the oil. You check the engine. How's it going?" And my dad said, "You haven't popped the hood, have you? For all you know, there's a bunch of squirrels running around in there." And I remember that thinking, wow, we ought to just know what's going on under the hood. And for a long time, I didn't know what was going on under the hood in my Bible. Do you know what's going on under the hood in your Bible? 400,000! Again, this is the liberal estimate. But there are a lot of variations in the manuscripts. But what do we do with this? Bart Ehrman has stated his case, saying that we have many manuscripts, but over 94% were made over the 8th century. In other words, 94% of our surviving manuscripts were produced 700 years or more after the originals. Do you remember the illustration that Dan used with the airlines? What's the airline you would choose? 94% sounds like a lot. So you start thinking about, but wait a second, how many is 6%? How many is 6%? 94% sounds like, wow, 700 years after, that's a long time for errors to creep in. And so you start realizing how many is 6%. Daniel B. Wallace, another leading textual critic, notes, we have today as many as a dozen manuscripts from the 2nd century, 64 from the 3rd, and 48 from the 4th. That's a total of 124 manuscripts with 300 years of the composition of the New Testament. Most of these are fragmentary, but collectively, the whole New Testament text is found in them multiple times. 6%, you have the New Testament multiple times. It can be cross-referenced, it can be checked, it can be verified. I want you to think about just the weight of evidence. Yes, yes, there are variations, but what do they lead to? They lead to this conclusion. We can say the text has endured alteration over the years because we can see where the alterations. You've been to a museum and seen a famous painting? How do you know that it's the original painting? Because somebody somewhere has the original painting. And I'll tell you, I know that there are museums that sometimes don't put the originals out there. They put replicas out there because they're protecting the original from being stolen one day. Because if a thief comes in and steals a replica, so they'll swap it out from time to time. But they know what the replicas are because they know what the original is. We know where the variants are because we have some kind of idea of what the original should look like. The reason we know it's a variant is because we're pretty sure that we can have a reasonable grasp of what the original wording is. And it's fairly certain that I am reading what is the original wording, that I am not left an out. Bart Ehrman says, in spite of these remarkable textual differences, scholars are convinced that we can reconstruct the original words of the New Testament with reasonable, although probably not 100% accuracy. He admits, he was on a radio show one time, and the radio host said, well, what do you think the original New Testament probably said? And Bart Ehrman just kind of, well, what do you mean? He said, yeah, what did the original New Testament say? Probably what it says today. With 100% accuracy. These variants can sometimes shake us, but we need to realize what they are. What are some of the variations? I'm going to read for you one that is probably the hardest, one of the hardest, it's not the hardest, but it's one of the hardest that we deal with. Dan mentioned sometimes, you know, as we make these copies, not we, but an ancient scribe, but as these copies were made, sometimes you'd repeat a letter, repeat a line, repeat a word, misspell a word. Well, that's easy. Anybody looking at this, oh, well, you didn't mean to say horse, like it's horse, but horse. You know, like, nay, horse. And so, you know, that's obvious. But one of the ones that's more difficult is this. In 1 Thessalonians 2:7, where Paul wrote, "We were gentle among you." Scholars are divided over whether that says "we were gentle among you," or in 1 Thessalonians 2:7, "we were little children among you." To some degree, it ought to matter. We want the Bible to be accurate, but is the meaning affected? There are very, very, very few. Less than 1% of all textual differences or variants are both viable, meaning that they, you know, are you can't tell, and meaningful. Let me tell you the other variation. One medieval scribe translated the text this way: "We were horses among you." Wouldn't that have been obvious? If you're a textual critic looking at the available manuscripts, trying to make a good copy, you've got six manuscripts. "We were children. We were children. We were children. We were gentle. We were gentle. We were horses?" That's not going to fly. And so don't let this one throw you. Yes, there are variations. Yes, there were alterations in the text. But what does it mean? It means that, well, what this German historical, I didn't get there, but let me just point out what it means for our messy job here, is that really what we're needing to deal with is this one. It means that the original text was not really lost. It means that it wasn't really a bad editing job. And it means that the early ones didn't really alter anything. What it means is we've got to deal with our translations today. How do I deal with the apparent contradictions today? There's a lot to go back here and sift through, and I'd encourage you to do that on your time. But what we're going to look at here is what I'm convinced is really the problem. How do I deal with the contradiction? I don't explain it away by saying, well, maybe somewhere back there they made a mistake in the transmission of the text. No, there's too much evidence to say they probably didn't. So what do I do with it the way it reads in my English translation today? Let me get to this quotation. H.E. Steyer, Trustworthiness of the Gospels. He says, "The sources for the resurrection of Jesus, with their relatively big contradictions, are over details, present for the historian for this very reason a criterion of extraordinary credibility." Now, I would prefer if he had said "with their seemingly relatively big contradiction," because I will tell you, I don't think they're contradictions at all. But for a historian, he looks at this and says, wow, there are contradictions in the eyewitness testimony. And what that does for him is he says, they weren't in a back room somewhere cooking up a story to deceive the whole world. These were different men from different perspectives and different cultures that saw the same event and gave a story that was similar but told differently. What would it have been if 12 men came out and used the exact same words, the exact same story, exact same experience? I would say, wait a sec. You all got together and agreed on this. But for Steyer, he says, there's enough variation to make me realize this is authentic. So we need to deal with this. If there are found some real contradictions in the Bible to disqualify its infallibility, we still have to decide what to do with the testimony within it that agrees about a number of things. Among others, Jesus is the Messiah. That's not a contradictory idea in the Bible at all. Jesus is the Messiah. That's what the Bible testifies. He worked miracles. He forgave sins. Jesus prophesied his own death and resurrection. Jesus died on a Roman cross, and Jesus was raised bodily from the dead. If you throw out the rest and you just take this, what are you going to do with just this? And so we need to see at least what it agrees upon, but I would say that there's more to it than that. We're not going to touch on all of the contradictions. That's just 400,000. Those are just variations. But supposed contradictions. You can go on to infidelbible.com. You can go on to thebibleisalie.com. You can go on to a number of sites and just use Google or Bing or Yahoo or anybody search AOL anymore. But you search these things and just look up contradictions in the Bible and look it up and you'll find what people think are contradictions. Search it out. Figure it out. See if it really stands or not. But we're going to deal with just these because I think these are really important. One, the genealogies of Jesus. Two, the time of crucifixion can really be tricky. Number three, scenes of his resurrection and ascension. And finally, number four, the death of Judas. Now, let's dig into this pretty quickly here because I want to make time for some discussion. First of all, dealing with the genealogies of Jesus. Matthew's genealogy is relatively simple. And for Jesus, this is a genealogy that would appeal to the Hebrew mind. He takes us through Abraham, the father of the Jews, father of the Hebrews, and then through David and Solomon, two of the most respected kings in all of Israel's history. So not only is he son of Abraham, according to promise, he's also the son of David, and then through Zerubbabel, who would have been the heir of David, coming back into Jerusalem to help rebuild Jerusalem after it was destroyed by the Babylonians. And Joseph, and then finally we have Jesus. And so this really emphasizes his Hebraic ancestry. He is a Jew of Jews. He fits the promise. And that's Matthew's point. Then Luke's genealogy traces Jesus all the way back through Shem, Noah, Adam, and ultimately God. But there are some strange differences upon closer inspection. And that is this. In Matthew's genealogy, Solomon is the son of David, Jesus. But in Luke's genealogy, Nathan is the son of David, at least. There's some other variations. But then you have Zerubbabel. Then down the line, you have Jacob. But the father of Jacob, or father of Joseph, Jacob, but here the father of Joseph is Heli. So who got it right and who got it wrong? We should not approach contradictions as saying which one's right, which one's wrong. We should first seek to see how we can assimilate and understand an incorporation of the two seemingly contradictory ideas. Any good judge or jury would be expected to do the same in a court. Here's an eyewitness, he says this happened. He's taken an oath. Here's another eyewitness, he says this happened. He's taken an oath. Well, which testimony do I throw out? You don't throw out either unless instructed to by the judge. We need to take both into account and see how can both things be true. So our question is, how can both things be true? I'm not going to tell you the answer definitively. I don't know the definitive answer, but I'm going to give you two possibilities that I think are reasonable. And one is that Matthew gives the genealogy as Joseph being the husband of Mary. Matthew and Luke trace genealogy through Joseph and Mary respectively. So Matthew gives us the line of Jesus through Joseph. Remember, Joseph is not Jesus' biological father, according to the gospel account. And then Luke traces it through Mary, who is the biological mother of Jesus. Okay, so that would give us some different ancestry, some different lineage. That is probably the more popular view. I hate to be a guy on the fringe here. I'll give you the second view that I actually prefer. And this requires a little more thinking from the law of Moses. And that is that Matthew follows the legal ancestry, whereas Luke gives the biological natural ancestry. That is this, that there were times when a man might have no heir. But what does he do when he has no heir? According to the law of Moses, an heir was to be raised up by the next closest relative. You can read about that some in the story of Ruth, found in the book of Ruth. And this is exactly what happens with her. Her first husband dies, his brother died, and the father died, so there's no heir to be had. The next closest relative, which isn't Boaz, is another man. Well, he denies the right, and Boaz must do it. He marries Ruth, and they raise up a child. This seems to be also what happens with Matthew's genealogy and Luke's genealogy. Matthew gives the regal, but Luke gives the natural ancestry, saying, yes, by the time we get down to Zerubbabel, there needs to have been a change because there weren't heirs that could go all the way through. The line ended with no apparent heirs, so we had to think about who's the next closest relative. How does he trace back all the way to David? Well, not through Solomon, but through Nathan. He follows this natural lineage. You think about how does the heir idea work? How does the natural born idea work out? It's rather fascinating, but that's a way to explain it. In short, this is no contradiction, but rather a genealogical and cultural quirk. You know, we think, hey, if there's an ancestry, it's an ancestry. Because when you look at the law of Moses, it's trickier than that. Luke, and here's a point about this. Luke admits in Luke 1 that he gathered up eyewitness testimony, of which Matthew claims to be, would have known about Matthew's writing. I think it stands to reason that he would have known about Matthew 1. And I doubt Luke, being the historian that he is, well attested by even skeptics, to be one of the greatest historians ever, would have looked at Matthew's genealogy and said, yep, nope, scrap it. I'm going to come up with my own genealogy. I think he knew about this genealogy and chose to record for us another genealogy that also fit. So this isn't a contradiction. This is good reason for Luke saying, I'm not going to simply just copy it down. I'm going to include some other information that's helpful. Number two contradiction that's often brought up in dealing with the scriptures is the time of crucifixion. And this is probably the trickiest one we'll deal with. And that is that in Mark, we're told that Jesus eats the Passover with his disciples. He's then crucified at the third hour, and then he dies at the ninth hour on a Friday. In John, however, Jesus eats with the disciples before the Feast of Passover. So in Mark, he eats the Passover, but in John, he eats before the Feast of the Passover. And he's crucified not at the third hour, but at about the sixth hour. He dies at the ninth hour in Mark, but he dies on Friday in John. It's a little bit different as we go through here. There's a way to explain this as far as the Passover is concerned. And this can really throw us for a loop. And here's how we look at this. The timing seems different, but the difficulty is not so different when we understand what the Passover is. The Passover is actually two feasts that are incorporated into one. And again, we have to read more than just this select text to understand a contradiction, an apparent contradiction. We need to read the entire Bible text if it gets it right. I don't mean Mark and John are wrong. Luke states it clearly. What he says is the Feast of Unleavened Bread drew near, which is called the Passover. The Passover is one day, but by the time Jesus comes around, in that day, the Jews referred to the Passover, meaning the Passover, including the following 7 days, which would be the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So we're referring really to 8 days total. So when Jesus takes the Passover, he's eating the Passover, but it's before the Feast of Passover, which is the unleavened bread, Feast of Unleavened, the week following. And so you can see Exodus 12. I've listed these passages here for your own consideration as you work through this. But we see the unleavened bread was eaten from day 14 to day 21. The Feast of Unleavened Bread included the Passover memorial, and it's clearly practically stated in 2 Chronicles 35, in 16 through 19, where verse 19 refers to the whole event as this Passover. Burnt offerings were made as specified, and it means the day of preparation. The Passover wasn't the day of preparation for the Passover event itself, but it was the day of preparation traditionally, meaning Friday, preparing for the Sabbath day in which they could do no work. So it was the day of preparation that fell within the Passover week, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And this places Jesus dying on Passover Friday in all the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. When we understand that Law of Moses aspect and the Hebraic aspect, it really clears this up. But what about the time of day? This gets tricky. In Mark, Jesus is crucified at the third hour, when in John, he is crucified about the sixth hour. Ancient timekeeping was less standardized than today. In fact, earlier when Dan said we wouldn't be calling, if Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, we probably wouldn't be calling today, you know, the year 2016. Probably be year 8, the 8th year of our President Barack Obama. That's the way they kept time, was by the year of the ruler. And so it wouldn't be 2016 from the year of our ruler, it would be from the year of our national ruler, Barack Obama. And so timekeeping has changed, and not everybody agrees on it. There are certain people in parts of the world that don't say today is, you know, the year 2016. It's a different year totally. And so there are people even in the Jews' time that even being Jews refer to the time differently. For one, the day was divided into quarters as well as twelfths. So when it says the third hour, really that translates to a different hour of the day entirely. That's 9 a.m. The sixth hour would be the sixth hour of the day, not 6 a.m., but rather 12 noon. 12 hours in the day, and so the sixth hour is the middle of the day, and the ninth hour would be like 3 in the afternoon. You know, for me, this is like sort of trying to translate in my head, and I don't even know the language, but this, you got to think through the numbers here. But more than just being divided into quarters and twelfths, the third hour could be anywhere from 9 a.m. to 12 noon. John says about the sixth hour. And so what that means, if it's 9 a.m. to 12 noon, if it's divided into quarters, then what you have is really no contradiction. It's a variant in the way to express it. And so if he says 6 p.m., sacrifice of the Passover lamb, well, these people over here did it at a different p.m. because it was on a different day. Really, I'm not going to take the time to work through all of the variations of this idea, but just know that there was a Galilee time, there's a Judea time. Different peoples kept the calendars different way. And so John records one keeping of time. Matthew, Mark, and Luke record another keeping of time. And so this would account for another variation as well. The Jews were divided on how to count the start of the day. We count the start of our day as being sunrise, and really even more than that, for whatever weird reason, we say 12 midnight is the start of a new day. I'm trying to teach a six-year-old why that matters. Somebody help me out. I don't know why, but you know, what is today? What's the date of today? The 16th. I don't know that. It started when we were all sleeping. Hopefully you were asleep at 12 midnight. Why? I have no idea. That's about as weird as saying sunrise to sunset or sunset to sunrise. So for a lot of Jews, it was sunset to sunrise, and that's when the new day started. So Sabbath day, you want to make sure that you're not working when the sun sets, because when the sun sets, it's the start of a new day. Which is interesting, because when you read Genesis 1, it was evening and morning the first day. Not morning and evening, but evening and morning. But that's just the way they measured time. And so their measuring of time is different, even in their own culture. And when you start working out the numbers, it adds up. It's not a contradiction. It's a cultural quirk. And so it really fits quite very well. It's not a contradiction. It's a reasonable chronology. Let me give you what I think is a reasonable chronology here as we look at the seeming contradictions in Matthew. In Matthew, Mary Magdalene and other Mary go to the tomb. This is after Jesus is crucified. They go to the tomb. With an earthquake, an angel rolls back the stone, and not the stone, but the angel instructs the women. Jesus appears to them on their way to tell disciples, and then Jesus appears to disciples. Pretty straightforward. When you read Mark, Mary Magdalene, other Mary, and Salome go to the tomb. The stone has been rolled away, and a man sitting in the tomb instructs them. A man, not an angel, but a man. Okay. The women flee afraid. Okay, and that's where we leave off. In Luke, Mary Magdalene, Joanna, other Mary, and other women go to the tomb, finding it empty. Two men meet them in the tomb, reminding them of Jesus' words. Two men, not one. not an angel, but two men, witnesses of Jesus' words. The women tell the disciples, running to see. Jesus appears to the disciples going to Emmaus. Jesus also appears to Peter, then 12 in Jerusalem. Jesus ascends into heaven at Bethany. Here he appears to the disciples in Galilee. Here he ascends into heaven at Bethany. John, it gets even worse. In John, Mary Magdalene goes to the tomb. Doesn't seem like anybody else is with her. And sees that the stone has been rolled away. She runs to tell Peter and John, who run to see the tomb. Jesus appears to Mary. He appears to Mary. That's what it says. Tells the disciples. Jesus then appears to 12 in Jerusalem, and Jesus appears to Thomas. Seems like a lot of contradictions to me at first. Let me just go through this quickly and help you to see. I'm not going to give you, again, the definitive answer. Lots of people have done this in various numbers of commentaries, harmonies of the Gospels, and so forth. What I wanted to demonstrate, though, is that it can be done. But first point is this. If it says Mary Magdalene in one, and then Mary Magdalene, Joanna, other Mary, and other women go to two, it's an exclusion of information. If I say that I went to the store and got a gallon of milk, does that mean that my children didn't go with me and I didn't get a block of cheese too? It's information that wasn't included. It's not a contradiction. It's just information that didn't seem pertinent to the writer at the time. So the point of John is that Mary Magdalene has an experience of the tomb, but the point of Mark is something totally different, so he includes other women, a multitude of witnesses versus the quality of the witness itself. Point. It's a different perspective. It's not a contradiction. But here's my suggestion of what occurs. I can send the slide to you if you like, but this is helpful. First of all, women, including Mary Magdalene, go to the tomb. Secondly, an angel, having rolled away the stone, tells the women to tell the disciples to meet Jesus. Just one angel was there, but an angel that rolls away tells the women to do that. The women look in the tomb, speaking with angels within. The women run from the tomb, at first afraid, and then with joy to tell the disciples, not telling anyone else. One gospel says they go with joy. One gospel says they were afraid. Is it possible to have two emotions about the same event? Okay, that's not a contradiction. It's more information. Peter and John run to examine the tomb, seeing the burial wrappings of Jesus with them, then go home. Mary and the women have come back to the tomb where Jesus greets first Mary, then the other women, telling them again to tell the disciples to meet him in Galilee. They do, but notice the disciples don't go to Galilee. They don't go like they're supposed to. This is something that you don't understand unless you read all of the Gospels together. They're supposed to, but they don't go. And so, Jesus appears to Peter, as well as the disciples going to Emmaus, and then appears to the 12, rebuking them because they don't believe. Thomas isn't there, and so he appears to Thomas on the following Sunday. Then they go to Galilee to see Jesus as instructed. He appears on several more occasions, and finally in Bethany, he ascends into heaven from the Mount of Olives. That is as best as I can reconstruct a synopsis that does not offer any contradictions whatsoever with any of the gospel accounts. My point is that this is not the definitive answer, but my point is to demonstrate that it can be done. It is not unreasonable to think that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are all telling the truth. The third and final one, I'll do this quickly. Death of Judas is actually not a difficult one. It's just one that lots of people bring up. But the idea is that Judas dies in different ways. Matthew says that he hanged himself, and then the leaders of the Jews took counsel and used the money that they paid him, 30 pieces of silver, he threw back into the temple. They took that money and bought a burial place for strangers in what is called the Field of Blood today. Not an oil, but there is an idea in...
whatever it was.
Yeah, well, whatever it was Acts 1. You're right, there's another story here. And that seems to be the contradiction. First, he hangs himself, but Acts 1, Luke writes, the book of Acts, is that he acquired a field. Well, I thought they bought it. Well, here Luke says that Judas acquired the field with this reward of his wickedness, and he fell and burst open. And here's all the bowels gushing out, and the junior high boys are loving it. So that field was called Field of Blood, Akeldama. How do we deal with this? Well, it's really not as difficult as all this. I'm going to bring that back up so you can see this. The way that I would suggest to deal with this is that this inconsistency isn't so hard. Essentially what happens here is that the priests take the money that Judas threw back to buy the potter's field as a burial place. So they purchased the burial place. Judas hanged himself, but when rot set in, his body decayed in quite gory fashion. And this is noted in contrast. This is specifically noted by Luke, because it contrasts with Jesus' resurrection. His body was not allowed to decay or to corrupt, as recorded in Acts 2, Psalm 16, even though he died a criminal's death. But then how did Judas acquire the field? Well, the field was named Field of Blood. So acquire doesn't mean that he purchased it necessarily, but rather it means that that field became associated with Judas. Anybody passing by would have said, yep, that's the Field of Blood. We know who that belongs to that man gave up blood money. That man that betrayed the Lord and the Master. And so he became associated with his deed of betraying a man with a kiss, greedy for 30 pieces. I think that handles that seeming contradiction, but again, different perspectives for different purposes, and I'll leave you with these closing suggestions. Remember why we're having this discussion. The Bible is the only religious book that can really, the only religious book that sets itself up to be examined so critically, so carefully, that it could be disproved. Other religious books are set up so that they are either believed or not, but they cannot be tested in a real world atmosphere. The Bible can. It can be lined up with history and be disproven. As far as I can tell, it's not been disproven, though. If it is false, if it is a sham, a stunt, a fabrication, it can be disproven, exposed, ridiculed, and ultimately discarded. But this book begs to be tested, and it exists in such a way so that it can be inspected, not subjectively, objectively. And I think that sets the Bible apart in a very fantastic way. And so here are my suggestions. Number one, the Bible submits itself to this rigorous examination. Number two, before throwing out any testimony and selectively reading the scriptures, read it with care. In reading the Bible, I encounter what seems to be a contradiction. It may be that I've not carefully read the text and have wrongly pieced together the details. A closer inspection reveals no contradiction at all, and I would just summarize that point with read with care. Number two, it may be that when I find what seems to be a discrepancy or contradiction in the text, that there is some bit of historical or cultural information that would make sense of the available facts. A reasonable approach to the individual witnesses, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, would not be to throw out the testimonies that seem spurious at first glance, but rather to patiently conclude that they got it right, but there are certain particulars that I am not privy to, and I would call this read with humility. There may be more information that I don't yet know. I do this with my children. It may seem like a lie, but you know, maybe there's information that I don't know. Maybe there's information that I don't understand. They don't typically lie to me. Maybe they're telling the truth here. Maybe there's another piece of information that I didn't get. And I'll try to get that information, but I'm going to read with humility and listen with humility. And finally, read with sensitivity. And this is, if I find the Bible has within it a contradiction that I just can't reconcile, reconsider the intent of the writer. And this is probably one of the more difficult ones to do. But it means that Matthew has a different purpose in writing than John does. It doesn't mean that the facts are different, but it means that John emphasizes a certain idea that Matthew doesn't emphasize. And so what am I reading? Am I reading a different genre? Because in Genesis 1, it seems to be a contradiction with Genesis 2. Was it before there was vegetation, or was it after there was vegetation? Different focuses, different purposes in the writing. Understand what the intent of the writer is, and I call this read with sensitivity. Finally, I'll close with this quote from Mahatma Gandhi. Mahatma Gandhi was not a Christian, but he said, "You Christians looked after a document containing enough dynamite to blow all civilization to pieces, to turn the world upside down and bring peace to a battle-torn planet. But you treat it as though it is nothing more than a piece of literature." That if you read the book, if you read the Bible as just an ordinary piece of literature, quickly come to terms and realize that it's not. Good point. And I especially appreciate that first one. Our motivation for trying to believe a certain thing should come into play. And we ought to challenge our biases. If I want to believe there's a God, I ought to challenge that. If I want to disbelieve there's a God, I ought to challenge that too. I ought to be honest enough to try to tear down a belief so that I can really work hard to know what is true. And as far as that belief is concerned, whether or not there is a God, I don't think there's a certain person, I don't think there's a person that exists that is not biased one way or the other. We either really want there to be a God, or we either really don't want there to be a God. And we ought to challenge whatever our belief is so that we can try to be honest and come to know what the truth is.
Once at work to a church, but he said to me, he asked me, if God wanted us, I must say I didn't have a very good answer, probably have a better one now, but I'd like to see you say.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, I'd like to know what your probably better answer is.
I can answer that for him. God said, be ye therefore holy, for I'm holy. Truly desire to live a holy life, everything possible. You will not be like Adam. The Christ nature to obey God, you want to put Adam there. We've all had revelation. Humans operate.
I would agree essentially with that. And I would just suggest maybe to your friend or anyone who has the question, why didn't God make it more simple? I've tried asking my wife that. Why doesn't she just tell me what she wants? But my wife thinks she is telling me what she wants. But what she's telling me she wants is a relationship and not someone who just performs a certain number of tasks to her satisfaction. And I think sometimes we think God is just after me doing a certain number of things. When really, when we read the scriptures and realize this is a story, This is a letter. This is a commitment. This is a person with feelings and expectations and desires and dreams of his own. It tells us that we ought to respond to God in a different sort of way. Obedience is still required, and understanding what he wants from me is still really important. But why should I want to know is really the question. It's because I ought to care for him and love him and seek to be pleasing to him in this relationship. And that means not just knowing what he wants, but why and who he is. And God actually invites us through the scriptures to learn that. Was another hand over here? Yes, sir. Yes, in Genesis 1 and 2, the seeming contradiction, yes, sir. Before soil, yes. And just to add on to that idea, it seems that Genesis 1 tells a overall story of creation in sort of a song-like form, much like what Dan pointed out with 1 Corinthians 15. It seems like it is in a form, in a song-like form that's meant to be remembered so that children could understand some ideas about God, people could understand some ideas about God. Genesis 2 gives us more details about... I'm sorry? Oh, is that... I'm not sure. Yeah, maybe so. But in Genesis 2, it seems the intention is more on the relationship between man. Other thoughts, questions? Very much appreciate the attention everyone gave today, and very much appreciate the opportunity to come and share these things with you. I hope that... I doubt every question has been answered, but I hope that at least we have encouraged you to consider where you might find the answers. What I often tell people is, I don't have all the answers, but I know where to find them. And I do believe that we serve a God who wants us to know truth at least as much as he's revealed it. Some things I'll never know, but some things that I can know, I should know. And I think the Bible contains those. I'll turn things over to David or Joe if they'd like to make some closing remarks.